I will start by asking you might be the hardest question I ask, which is, you've written a book about Brian Pillman. Why?
Basically, it was a deal where I've been kind of an obsessive of Pillman for the longest time. I trained to wrestle in 2002 and 2003 myself at the FWA Academy in Portsmouth. And while I was down there, I was obviously trying to, you know, tape, watch, and study and kind of observe different guys. And some of the guys that kind of, you know, stood out to me were typical guys and who people who want to get into wrestling will watch and admire, like Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and guys of that ilk. But Pillman always stood out for me in kind of a very different way. Some of my earliest memories of wrestling are watching Brian Pillman and there being just something about him that was intangible that I couldn't really understand at the time that really kind of stood out to me. And I think looking at it now in retrospect, a lot of it was that you can kind of tell, and there are certain guys like this where that you can almost just sense that there's something more to them than what you see on the screen. You know, the old adage is that wrestling takes guys' personalities and you know, you dial a certain element of it up to 11 and kind of make it stand out. Whereas Brian was one of the people, especially in like the early 90s in WCW, where I thought you could really sense, and I thought Mick Foley was similar, where if anything, wrestling was kind of taking their natural personalities, which is like a 12 or a 13, and kind of dialing it down to a 6 or a 7, because WCW was a very kind of homogenized environment and it kind of restricted a lot of people. And I think over time that kind of proved to be true in both cases with Pillman and Foley, where, especially with Brian, as time went on and he kind of just became more of himself on camera, he just became more and more fascinating. And as time went by, you kind of study somebody, you read about somebody, and there was always just so much more to learn about Pillman. You know, there's just a fascinating component that he has that not a lot of people have, and I think it's the reason why 20 years later there's still this kind of underground cult phenomenon about Brian Pillman. There's something about him that just stands the test of time. Even though there's been a lot of guys who had that kind of unfortunate early ending to their lives, he's one of the few who really kind of stands out, you know, 20 years later, two decades on.
You mentioned the early 90s WCW, and you're lucky because I've listened to your podcast, The Squared Circle, Gazette Radio, and you lived in an area, or live in an area, where you could watch WCW on ITV. Here in Yorkshire, we didn't get that option. We just used to look in the TV magazines and look on jealously to the other regions.
Oh, really?
We didn't get WCW. It was on at 3 in the morning in Granada or Central or whatever, but in Yorkshire we never got it. So my first exposure to Pillman, if you will, which is probably a bad choice of words when we talk about his ECW run, but it was Super Brawl 1. My mum brought me Super Brawl 1 on VHS. She must have got it like, cheap in a sale somewhere. So my first exposure was watching a tape fist match against Barry Windham. But you're exactly right. It's that unintelligible thing. You can't put your finger on what it is. That X factor, I guess, is the modern phrase. There was something about Brian Pillman that made him so watchable, even in terrible situations.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned there that Super Bowl 1 period. That was right in the middle of a period of time when he was supposed to be getting a big push, and this would happen a lot in WCW, where he'd be supposed to be on the docket for something big, and then as time went by, whether it was the whims of a booker or there was just, you know, there was a higher priority, whatever happened, one thing after another, it always fell through, and that was the sad part. But I think the kind of sign of resilience, and again, the talent of Pillman was that he didn't let it get in the way, and he was always trying to find the next thing that would help boost him up. You know, even when he got stuck with like the yellow dog shortly after that match you're talking about, you know, it's like he still kind of persevered and kind of found a way to press on and forge ahead.
And even when they brought in the light heavyweight division, as soon as that came, it was almost cancelled straight away. And he had great matches in that division, as a great character as he was, of course. And that was more important later in his career. He also had a great body of matches as well.
Yeah, his ring work, especially, it's really interesting. It's one of the things that's kind of I was really kind of keen to track in the book was when people kind of really start to figure out that he was going to be something special and was something special. Because, you know, early on in Stampede, I mean, he was thrown on television about 6 or 7 weeks after he started training. It wasn't long. You know, you get guys now who have been, like, you know, in that kind of perpetual state of training for months and years sometimes even. And even, you know, even now, like, you've got a completely different culture where you've got the performance center in the WWE where you can constantly be honing your craft and constantly be working and evolving in that environment, a training school situation. You know, Pillman was kind of thrown to the wolves pretty early on. And it was kind of cool to talk to different people and it comes out in the book, who kind of looked at him early on and said, you can see the potential in him. And then by the time late 1989 rolls around, and he's starting to get like big chances, like Lex Luger at Halloween Havoc was a big one, and it's like Flair in February 1990, and everybody all of a sudden kind of realizes, you know what, this guy's kind of quietly become quite sensational. And from that point, it's like you would kind of mentally consider him always one of the top in-ring wrestlers in the business. I should say in WCW. In WCW, he was certainly one of the top guys who would be considered for performances. And you look at his pay-per-view track record, and he had so many great matches on pay-per-view. And again, it was always overlooked. It wasn't what they were looking for at the time.
It's a sad ending to his story, of course, but it's almost a miracle that he became a professional wrestler and indeed an NFL professional footballer as well, because he had so many health issues as a child.
Yeah. It's only health issues as a child. And the thing, too, is that he always had, and it's one of the parts of the book that I think it's one of the more accessible issues, and I think it's something that when the WWE did their DVD in 2006, they really kind of played on it, but I don't think they really told the story as well as they could, which again was part of the motivation for why I wanted to write the book about Brian, because as good a job as they did by their own standards, I thought they missed out so much of the story. And so much of that is that even though he was considered a small guy in almost every world he ever went in, he always found a way to try to offset that, to try and offset the fact that he was small and it was something that people could overlook him for. And unfortunately, they often did overlook him. And again, like almost every avenue he went into was an unlikely one. You know, he's a hockey player, first and foremost. He loved hockey. Undersized, playing in adults, grown men's traveling hockey teams, and he's a 15-year-old kid. But he's thriving, and he's like all-city, all-state as a hockey player. He becomes a high school football player and gets given all the worst equipment, but at the same time manages to blaze a trail and gets to the NFL. And that's kind of really one of the things that was fun about the book. It was not just taking something like that, that at face value is like something you can sum up in a couple of sentences, but there's so much more depth to the story, and that's the fascinating stuff with Brian. It's the fascinating stuff with his story is it's not just small guy finds a way to make it because he's good. It's small guy gets these obstacles thrown in his way, and he navigates them in just the most interesting and unique way. And it really kind of it plays out to this tremendous story that hopefully this book has been able to capture.
You've been able to speak to many and various people from all walks of his life, from Kim Wood, from his football career, and obviously his family himself, from the likes of Raven and Jim Cornette, who've worked with him in wrestling, and outside of the business, but inside the business, in Mark Madden and Dave Meltzer. What was the biggest thing you'd learned, perhaps, about Brian Pillman that you didn't know before you wrote the book?
Oh, wow. That's probably going to be the toughest question that you asked me today, I think, because there was just so much, there was so much. I think that's the thing and it's kind of what kind of encouraged me to do this whole book in the first place, was that there is a general knowledge, I think, of Brian Pillman's story. But the thing that interested me and always has done was that when you kind of scratch beneath the surface, there's always a different layer, and there's always a different detail. And then when you scratch beneath that, there's even more, and then even more. It's like the most layered onion of a story that you could possibly imagine. And I think in terms of what was the biggest thing to learn, it's difficult, but I think that one of the things that really kind of stood out for me was just how well he was able to kind of read people and read the environment. And again, it's more just kind of understanding Brian's intelligence has been kind of one of the biggest points of learning throughout this entire thing, because when I would talk to people, they would always have a different take on the way Brian was with them. I would talk to Kim Wood, who has all these incredible stories about him in the Bengals, him trying to make the Bengals, and stories about him fighting people, and stories about him with women. And then I'll talk to Colin Bauman, who is a Glaswegian, who worked for WCW magazine, who was the editor for a number of years. And I would kind of start the conversation by saying something like how I understand that Brian had a very wild personality, and then he would come back and say something like, well, yes, but at the same time, I never saw as much of that as other people did because he was different with me. And then when I was talking to Dave Meltzer, the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, one of the things that Dave pointed out was that if he wanted to tell a story about a woman that he's been with or something sensational that's happened, he would call Mark Madden because that was Mark Madden's personality. But if you wanted to talk about Luthers at 4 o'clock in the morning, he'd call Dave Meltzer. You know, he had different people for different things, and it was almost this kind of sixth sense that he had, an ability to read people and kind of know what appealed to them and know how to be with different people. And you know, one of the kind of the big overriding themes of the book is Brian's ability to navigate certain situations based on his ability to read people. And it's like he could see what appealed to people. He knew how to appeal to them specifically, and he would kind of play on that, kind of advance. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, being manipulative. It was just the sense of, okay, I know that what will speak to this person the best, just from being around them a little bit, will be this. And again, it's just, it harkens back to that intelligence, and you hear it a lot, but it really kind of stands out with Brian. I think it really comes through in the book, is just how much of a scholar he was, and between a natural intelligence and just a desire to always learn, you know. And that's something that I think really kind of stands out when you kind of contrast this to the modern day, where there are tons of people who are students of the game, but Brian's almost a student in a different sense, in that he would always try new things, and he would always gamble. He would always, you know, if you kind of considered the landscape in the early 90s in WCW, the idea of, I'm going to lobby to bring in Jushin Liger, this guy from Japan, who everybody on the underground knows who he is and knows how good he is, but the general American wrestling business does not know this complete stranger, but I'm going to bring him in and bank my own career on bringing this guy in and working with him, because on the off chance that it will work out for me. You know, it's like he would always take risks, he would always take gambles, and I think one of those, and that kind of, again, it's the theme of his entire career, the amount of research he did to kind of make the loose cannon perfect. I mean, it was a 24-hour-a-day thing for him, that knowledge gathering and kind of that instinctual intelligence. That really kind of stands out in this book.
And I guess the loose cannon character, you mentioned intelligence, it's the intelligence to know exactly the situation within the wrestling industry at that point in the mid-90s. It was the perfect time for that kind of character.
Yeah, but it really was. The perfect character for the perfect time. Which is funny because I always kind of, you would hear those whispers from fans about how Brian Pillman was so ahead of his time. But at the same time, I always kind of had that kind of niggling thing in my head of what you just said, Richard, which is, I actually think that it was the perfect gimmick for the perfect time. I think he was the master of the time he was in many ways, because if you tried to do that now, you could do it to a degree, and CM Punk pretty much replicated the entire thing in 2011 when he's doing the shoot interviews and the pipe bomb and all that stuff. And it did capture the imagination because, you know, the wrestling audience has changed. You know, that kind of, there's a bit more of a kind of proliferation, I suppose, of people knowing what's going on the inside of the business. But back then, it was right at the cusp of when that started to happen. You know, the internet in 96 wasn't what it is now. But at that time, there were certainly pockets of smarter wrestling fans, let's put it that way. People who knew what was really going on, kind of understood how the backstage machinations kind of worked. And there was a desire to kind of learn more, and a desire to know more from the fans. And I think that one of the interesting things about that whole loose cannon thing with Pillman is the avenues he went to appeal to that small fan base. And by percentage at the time, it was a small percentage. Yeah, but, you know, things he would do on AOL, you know, things he would do in ECW, it's all underground. You know, things to appeal to newsletters and hotlines. Like, you know, the famous one, obviously, is him and Kevin Sullivan with the I Respect You Booker Man. But when you think about it, at that time, how many people really knew what a Booker Man was? You know, by percentage. If you said it now, a lot of, you know, the percentage is way higher. Back then, the percentage is minimal. But again, it all ties into the intelligence of Pillman to kind of understand that even if that percentage at the time was really small, that percentage was a very, very loud voice at the time, you know, because WCW and the WWF are right at the start of the Monday Night War. They Raw and Nitro head-to-head every Monday, and neither company had broken ahead yet. They were very even. It was a level playing field, and both sides were looking for anything to kind of indicate that this, you know, if you go in this direction, this will push you ahead a little bit further. And all these avenues that Pillman took was a calculated attempt to get all these people talking about him, so that the, you know, whether it be Bischoff or McMahon, even if they weren't completely listening to those fans, they could still hear them. They could hear the noise, and Pillman was making a lot of noise during that period.
And played both sides off against each other to get that contract with WWF at the time as well.
Which is brilliant. It's one of the most brilliant things, because he always had, I mean, the thing is with Pillman, he always did get pretty good contracts. relative to, I think that's kind of one of the unspoken, you know, not necessarily needed to be spoken things, is it's not like he was ever getting shortchanged in his deals. You know, I mean, when he got first signed to WCW, he was getting $2,000 a week. And for a guy 2-3 years in the business at that point, $2,000 a week's pretty damn good. I mean, that's, he got to a pretty good level pretty quick. Kip Fry offered him $225,000 a year in 1992. He got pretty much that same deal for the next 4 years. And then when he finally came to that loose can, he wanted more. He wanted a bigger contract. And you could argue that he probably deserved and probably should have had a bigger deal earlier than he did, because obviously he merited it, certainly. But it was that thing, if they weren't going to push him to the top, they were never going to give him a chance. And he had to find a way to make his own break. And I think, you know, one of the big things that he was able to cotton onto, and I think a lot of guys did, he wasn't the only one, but he saw Luger, and he always had that thing with Luger, and I'm sure you've heard it before, that he resented the fact that Lex would always get big contracts, no matter what the situation. He always managed to find a way to play the situation so well. You know, like, it started back in like 1987 with Lex, when Jim Crockett's offering him, you know, $350,000 a year based on potential, because there was a fear he was going to go to the WWF. You know, in 1995, I heard that first Nitro, Lex Luger was kind of considered a bit of a WWF washout. You know, he'd failed as a top guy in the WWF. And Bischoff initially didn't want him until he saw the value of, you know, the shock move to establish Nitro. All of a sudden, he was so valuable. And Bischoff kind of went against his own initial small offer for Lex and really kind of threw a lot of the cards on the table and gave him a huge offer. And Pillman just took one look at that and couldn't believe it. It's just like, this guy's just proven that he can't play at the big level and he can't deliver, but you're going to give him a big contract anyway, and therefore he's going to get treated like a top star. And that was obviously Pillman's big thing. It was something I was kind of trying to get to the bottom of when I was interviewing guys. Like, was it about, you know, because you always hear that Brian was very business-oriented. It was about the money. But at the same time, there was a pride about trying to be a main eventer. And, you know, his natural attitude, and he kind of had an alpha male personality anyway. It had to drive him crazy that no matter what happened, he couldn't get the position he wanted or the money he wanted. And he figured out a way where, if this will be the way to get the money I want, which will then translate into me getting the position I want, because with one comes the other.
There's so many facets of his in-ring career. There's so much to get involved with. I can't wait to read the book, such as, you know, he's running the Four Horsemen, which was a dead duck after the 93 incarnation with Paul Roma. But he and Chris Benoit, dare we say his name, revitalised the Four Horsemen, and then it was killed off by WCW again. But so many things that he was involved with in his career. And of course, the loose cannon persona, he had to reinvent himself because of those out-of-the-ring injuries, which meant he couldn't go anymore.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things that kind of worked. It kind of played on itself in a strange way, because he was physically banged up anyway before the accident. I mean, he had problems with his back dating back to 1991. He had a lot of muscle injuries. You know, he tore his tricep in Stampede. He tore his hamstring in the Bengals. You know, there's a lot of injuries that he broke his wrist. You know, there's a lot of stuff that he did that, you know, he was feeling it. By 1995, he was feeling it. And he kind of knew. It's one of the things that, again, it came out in the book, and I, in speaking to Dave Meltzer, Meltzer said to me that he had a conversation with Brian where Brian went to Japan in, like, June of 95 to do the Best of the Super Juniors tournament. It's like an annual tournament where they bring in all these, you know, junior heavyweights from around the world. And New Japan had the business relationship with WCW. So they had Pillman go over. They had Alex Wright go over. But also, you got, like, a lot of the guys who are already in New Japan, like Benoit and Malenko and Guerrero. You know, guys that would eventually, in a not too distant future, came to WCW. And so what ended up happening was, Pillman's working with these guys, and all of a sudden, he kind of realizes that, you know, what had been his calling card, it was like his fail-safe, like you say, was that he was very good in the ring, and he was considered very good in the ring. He wouldn't really be often given chances to show his personality, and at that point in 95, he hadn't been given a chance to show his personality since the Hollywood Blondes in 93, before they got broke up. So it had been about a year and a half, and yeah, he really was, you know, I think it was a bit of a rude awakening for him on that tour, because when that tour was finished, he came back and he called Dave Meltzer, and he basically just said, look, these guys are so good. I mean, I'm sure you know when you see them, but it's different working with them. When you work with them, you understand how good these guys are, and he knew they were coming in. And at the same time, you know, he was a student of the game, and he saw Rey Mysterio Jr., who was picking up steam, and he just thought, you know, I can't be flying Brian as soon as Rey Mysterio gets picked up, and Rey will get picked up. He knew it before most that Rey was going to be big in America. And he just thought, you know, I'm going to be made obsolete. You know, my one calling card is going to be made obsolete. So what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to become a character. I'm going to have to do something that's different. So I'm not just known for being a good wrestler. And of course, he plays on all these canon things. And as we go into him in the book, he goes so deep into the loose canon character that he basically becomes the loose canon character in real life and starts making these decisions and starts doing these really impulsive things that are really kind of, you know, they kind of counter what the original idea of the gimmick was, which was to work the world and pretend to be something that he really wasn't just to get people talking. Well, as time went by, you know, he was living it so much, it's one of those things, and it's kind of like one of the tragic tales of and you hear about that a lot with actors. You know, Heath Ledger was similar when he tried to be the Joker for The Dark Knight, and he ended up researching the character so much that he put himself in a depression. You know, it's like you read about that kind of thing a lot. And it happened with Brian, where he had a lot of traumatic things happen in his life, but he ended up pretty much kind of diving into it. I don't know if it was escapism. I don't know if it was just, you know, he was so obsessed, and he knew he was onto a winner. But he became the loose cannon in real life very much. And then when the accident happened, which is kind of a direct result of that, it was one of those things where, like you say, he had to ramp up the loose cannon element of his act because he couldn't really do anything in the ring anymore. You know, it took him, if he thought he was going to be limited compared to the likes of Guerrero and Mysterio, he was limited by anybody's standards after the Humvee wreck. He really should have, he shouldn't have come back, in truth.
And I guess in terms of his WWF career, there's not really much to talk about. It's in the ring, but out of the ring, obviously, there's the famous gun angle on Raw, which will be talked about till the end of time, and the fact that he has added a great word to the wrestling lexicon in someone's ankle being pilmanized, which people still use to this day, which is a superb word, but obviously not the best of words.
And that was interesting too, because, you know, everything that was going on at the time, he was getting a lot of pressure from, I mean, he had self-imposed pressure anyway to come back. You know, he really hated the fact that he had that injury when he did. I mean, like, I don't think there's any way, even in a book, to put into words just, you know, what other people, I had so many people tell me that in conversations they had with Brian, he was distraught. He was just, you know, it was one of those things where you can just see the desolation in somebody's face when they talk about it, because it's like this helplessness. And again, you almost kind of, to overcompensate for that, they would do these things like, okay, we haven't had Pillman do all that much for the first 3 or 4 months of this contract. And you know, the guys were talking about it, but wrestlers weren't happy, you know, because they've been dealing with years of WWF's, you know, peculiar contracts where you get given an opportunity and no guaranteed money. And here's Brian with this great huge guarantee, you know, kind of strolling the door and not really doing much for the first 3 or 4 months because he couldn't. And then so what you were getting in response is Vince would say, well, let's do something big. Let's justify it, which is kind of exactly what Pillman wanted all along. And then you get stuff like the gun angle, which is, like you said, is going to be talked about until the end of time. And the kind of strange thing about it is it really, at the time, it made a big noise, certainly. But it wasn't like it was something that really made a huge dent in the landscape, other than it got a lot of people talking for a few weeks. But at the same time, it's one of those things, again, it's bizarre, it's endured. You know, like you mentioned, it's going to get talked about forever, the time that Brian Pillman pulled a gun on Raw, live. You know, it's pretty insane when you think about it now. Can you imagine someone doing that now?
Well, until he gets it'd probably be more negative interest these days than he would have done in the late 90s.
Yeah.
I guess if things get desperate, you'd hope they wouldn't.
You'd hope they wouldn't. And again, tenor of the times is one of those things where, and it actually kind of goes a lot. It's almost like a strange, it feels like another world. You know, if you're watching at that time, it really does feel like another planet. To watch wrestling and kind of follow, go back and look at the news in 97 and 98 and 99 in wrestling, and just seeing, first of all, how quick everything moved, and secondly, how almost rash so many of the decisions were, because week to week, it was like on everybody's mind constantly that we're in this war and we need to find anything, whether it be large, whether it be small, we need to find anything that's going to help us along, because whether WCW wants to increase their lead when they took over at first, or whether WWF's trying to find a way to get back in the fight, nothing seems like it's working. I mean, that leads to a lot of the decisions, and pretty much was the crux behind, okay, the Raw time slot's changing, we need something big. Brian, we're going to have you pull out a gun on live TV. You know, it's like it's a totally different world of thinking to now, where you've got 3 hours, and they'll put, you know, a lot of things on that really you think, what are they doing putting this in the main event? You know, now it seems like they don't really calculate things all that much or put that much importance on 1 week. Back then, every week was life and death.
I think as we say often when we review Raw, we say it was on for 3 hours and some stuff happened, and that's about it. it just seems to... I watch it on fast forward mostly, it's just waiting for something to appear, or I've already listened to a review or whatever. But you mentioned chasing ratings, and I guess, sadly, his death turns into that. Obviously, you found dead in his hotel room on the 5th of October in 1997, but the day after on Raw and in subsequent weeks, I think of all the things we can blame WWE Astro Vince McMahon for that they've done over however many years, the interview with his wife Melanie the day after and in subsequent weeks, that must be up there with one of the worst things they've done.
Yeah, I think you've probably summed that up better than most could. I think there's a lot to that too. That's a very strange deal, because when you get the book, I'd love to know what you think, Richard, just about that last few months of his life, because when that whole thing happened with Melanie, and I hate that too, and you know, you look at it and it's like, the way they zoom in on the face, and you have Vince McMahon asking, have you had any chance to think about what you, now as a single parent, are going to do to provide for your 5 children? And it's just like, what do you want out of this? Like, and the way they built it up the whole show, you know, it's like, coming up next, or coming up later, you know, we're going to be talking to the widow. And it's just like, it's so chilling, and it's so vile. And then you kind of learn... Again, you kind of peel beneath the surface and you realize that, you know, Melanie and Brian, they were not getting along at the end at all. I mean, for the last few months, I mean, they were going through a very, very, very trying divorce. And there were a lot of things happening on both sides, not just Melanie's front, not just Brian's front, where they, I mean, it was volatile and it wasn't good. And it was a situation where people who I spoke to who knew said that something bad was going to happen there between those two. You know, one way or the other, it wasn't going to end well. And so I think, yeah, that's one of the things where you always kind of... I always looked at that whole thing with Melanie the day after on Raw as, how can Vince be so manipulative to do something like that? How can he be so cold-hearted? And I agree, and it is. It is, no matter how you look at it. It's the sleaziest thing. And then, again, you peel beneath the surface, and it's almost like... It almost makes it feel even more kind of hollow, I guess. I don't know. It's just, you look at it, you see it for what it is. It's deplorable no matter what angle you look at it. And the fact that they even... I can't even comprehend them doing it. Again, you look at the tenor of the times and you look at the modern day. It speaks to how desperate they were that they would do something like that. Whether it be damage control, because it was obviously one of the first major deaths on their roster, of a major star. They'd had other people die. Rick McGraw had died when he was under contract. But this is the first one where it was like, here's a guy who's a current star, and he's just died. He's being featured heavily, and he's died, and we think it's drugs, but we don't know yet. And at that point, they didn't know. They didn't know what the cause of death was at the time. They assumed overdose because they'd had all the stories, and they knew what was going on with Brian. They knew he was having problems. And then... But like I said, it's damage control. And Bruce Pritchard had mentioned something on his podcast about how, for anybody who second guesses the fact we did that, you know, F you. And it's like, you know what? No, sorry. 20 years later, it still comes off as callous and sleazy and cheap and desperate as it did back then. If anything, more so, because yeah, as you learn, and as you're reading the book, everybody in that, there were no innocent parties in this thing. It all comes off terrible. It's just disgusting.
I guess the worst thing is that they had time to plan, whereas with Owen Hart's death, they didn't have time. It was just a spur of the moment decision. And whether you think it's right or wrong, at least you can have that as an excuse for that, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, you're right. That's one of those things, because when Owen died, you hear all that, they carried on the show. They carried on the show. Should they have carried on the show? And it's like, I always think, and I wrote this in a book about this situation, which is that in the aftermath of someone's death, especially if it's a shock death, like an Owen, like no one can predict, you know? And to a degree, even though Brian was, you know, everyone knew that Brian was in rough shape, and some people were saying, you know, we need to be really careful about Brian. It wasn't like anybody expected it, you know what I mean? But with Owen, because it was on the fly, it's like, I can't say, like I said, I wrote in the book, anything when it's a shock death, in the first 24 hours afterwards, I always kind of give a bit of a benefit of the doubt, because I'm not in that situation. I'm not the one who has to make the decision. And when something like that just is, that's so surreal. We've all had those moments in our life, whether it be, you know, a loved one dying or someone breaking bad news or something like that, where it just completely throws you for a loop, and all of a sudden the world just feels completely different. You know what I mean? It's like it really kind of shakes you up. It's like in that kind of erratic moment of your brain trying to process the news, you know, maybe you don't make the best decisions. You know, maybe you don't make the best calls. You know, letting the show go on with Owen, probably not the best call, but again, it's made under duress. You know, so you always got to think there's a bit of a benefit of the doubt. But this was 24 hours later. And again, you know, 24 hours is not the longest time to get over something. But from Vince's perspective, the idea of this shocking thing's happened, how do we deal with it? Let's call up the widow and put her on television so I can ask her how she's going to provide for her kids. That's the lowest of the low. And it is one of the lowest moments in the history of the company, I think.
Thankfully, you would hope that things have... lessons have been learnt in the prior 20 or the 20 years following Brian Pillman's death. What would you say would his legacy have been on the wrestling industry today?
Oh, wow. Well, this is the thing. I mean, one of the more kind of interesting and longest debates you can have is the what if, the what could have been discussion. You know what I mean? Like, if he hadn't died, where would he have ended up? And what would have his legacy been? What would have happened if he didn't have the wreck when he did? You know, there's so many different elements to that you can really get into. You can spend hours talking about that and thinking about that. When you actually look at, you know, the legacy that he did have, and you know, 2 decades on, what legacy did he have? I think that you've got a lot of change in the business that kind of happened with him at the forefront. And I think the thing that's kind of tough to gauge is whether or not those changes would have happened anyway, and he knew it, and he was just on the crest of the wave and knew that he was going to be the first, or if it was something that kind of came along because of what he did. Because consider that before Brian did that whole thing in WCW with the loose cannon and the Booker Man tying into reality, it wasn't like playing into the reality of wrestling was something that either WCW or the WWF did. You know, WWF at the time had, you know, dentists and pirates and school teachers and, you know, and gimmicks. WCW had the Dungeon of Doom. So everybody's still stuck in this mentality of we've got to play pretend. And ECW was doing stuff that was far more real and far more kind of to the, you know, cut into the bone type of stuff. But neither WCW or the WWF were really kind of, you know, taking it and appropriating it for themselves yet. And Brian was the first to really kind of bring a bit of reality into wrestling, you know, especially, you know, for the first time in a while anyway. You know, you're bringing, you know, elements of, you know, he's fighting with the company, he's fighting with the Booker, we think that there's problems here. You'll be saying, you know, Booker Man and Smart Marks and all this stuff. And it was kind of a, like you say, a knock-on effect. I'm not sure, maybe, but as a result of this, and because of the amount of noise that it made and the amount of attention it attracted, you know, when they first brought in the NWO, there are so many elements of real life and, you know, you're kind of mentioning where you come from and the names involved that I'm not sure that they would have necessarily done if it wasn't for the fact that they'd done it first with Pillman. You know, the whole Montreal screw job and the reaction to that, where Vince just decides he's going to put on the air that, you know, this thing happened, the time-honored traditions, and, you know, he didn't want to lose and stuff like that, and becoming Mr. McMahon. I mean, these big angles that happened, they had roots in the fact that they dealt with reality, and that was something that Brian introduced to the big two. Like I said, ECW were doing it, but it was about, you know, it getting into WCW and kind of people feeling that if you did it on a main stage, it could work. And yeah, it can translate. Now, of course, there were about 1,000 attempts at other things that didn't work nearly as well. But I think that when you actually kind of look at, you know, the influence of Brian, it's like you can look at the cruiserweights today and say, would there have been a cruiserweight division now, rightly or wrongly, of course, not doing a great job with it, but would it have even happened if it wasn't for Brian pitching for the light heavyweight division back in 91? You know, would the cruiserweight division in 96 have happened if it wasn't for the fact that Pillman in early 95 was lobbying to bring it back and say, you know, I'll be a heel and build it around me, and then we can bring, you know, we can bring in Benoit and Sabu, who had, you know, a big rep at the time in ECW. We can bring in guys from Mexico, because he's a big Lucha fan. He wanted to work with Super Astro. You know, you have all these different elements of Brian where he kind of, in an, like an inadvertent way, it might have happened anyway, who knows, but he was right on the crest of the wave with so many things. And you look at right now where, you know, the size barrier has changed in wrestling. And it's one of those kind of sad things where you're like, I think Raven in the book, he put it best when he said, if Brian had come along 20 years later, the size issue changed so dramatically, he'd have been a top guy. If he'd have come along 20 years earlier, he would have been on top of all the small territories because he was the kind of guy you could build around. You know, the old bookers used to say that the perfect babyface was a guy that guys wanted to hang out with and women wanted to be with. And that was Brian in real life. And it wasn't like it was a, you know, even a character he had to portray. He had a very boisterous, gregarious, natural personality in the real world. And there's a lot of stories about that in the book too, which are just ridiculous. But yeah, in terms of the influence on the business, I'm not sure that it would look, I think it would look very different right now if it wasn't for Brian, because, you know, I think the size issue changed because of him. I think the reality in wrestling changed because of him. And yeah, I just think it would be a very different landscape right now. I'm not sure how it would look.
Life would be very dull if we didn't have what if questions to answer, I guess. And the book is called Crazy Like a Fox. You must be very pleased, by the way, that Alicia Fox is wearing your book title on her T-shirts at the moment. It's a nice free publicity for you.
I love the free publicity. I got to be honest with you, Richard. And it's funny because I came up with the game. I was considering about five or six different titles for the book until eventually it's like, you know what? It needs to be, because one of the overriding themes of the book is that there's this intermixing of good and bad in Brian's real and professional life. You know, it's like there's high points, there's low points, there's good, there's bad. He's intelligent, but he acts impulsive. He's a complex guy, but he can act very simple. And it's like, I need something that really encapsulates it. So, you know what? Crazy Like a Fox kind of says it all. I think that's kind of perfect. And then I make the press release. That's what it's going to be called, you know, 20 years after the day of his death, we announce the book's coming out, and then about 3 days later, this T-shirt comes out that says Crazy Like a Fox, for Alicia Fox, and I just, yeah, you kind of, it's like, well, you know what, if you want to billboard it, that's fine with me.
Have you bought the T-shirt? That's the main question.
I haven't. I got to be honest, I haven't. Maybe someone can send it to me for Christmas, and I'll be over the moon. But until that day, I think I'll stick with the copies of the book.
Excellent, Liam. I'm really looking forward to reading it when it arrives in my letterbox. Crazy Like a Fox, a definitive chronicle of Brian Pillman, 20 years later, by Liam O'Rourke. It's available on Amazon and all the usual places, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon's the place to go. They've got, you know, obviously it's Black Friday weekend, so. If you're in America, they've got a better deal than we get here in the UK for some reason. We don't get any discounts in the UK, so that kind of sucks. But yeah, Amazon.co.uk is the place to be. And hey, let me know what you think of it, Richard.
Excellent. We'll do. And we can find you on Twitter and also your own podcast as well, Squared Circle Gazette Radio.
Yep, squaredcirclegazette.com. And my Twitter is @LeamO'Rourke86. If you want to follow me on there, by all means.